All right. Thank you, John. We are in Revelation chapter 7. Let's just get over there here. Revelation chapter 7 is kind of an interlude. We had the six seals being broken already, and we saw that that brought all kinds of misery to the Roman Empire generally. And now between the sixth and seventh seal, there is this, a lot of people call it an interlude or a pause. Between the two, and the purpose of that, as John says in chapter 7, verse 1, you know, he says, I saw the four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds of the earth. Well, in one verse, we have the number four used three times. So there is some significance to that. We'll cover that in our study on numbers, not the book, but numerology. As an archetype, the number four plays predominantly in the scriptural, you know, perspective of things. So, and four almost always has to do with the world, the physical world, because the elements are four, right? Earth, wind, fire, and what's the other one? Huh? Well, earth, wind, fire, and water, yeah. So those four elements are thought to be, you know, the basic components, the basic fundamental building blocks of the world, of the earth. So whenever you see the four mentioned, it usually has to do with, or almost always has to do with, the earth. And there's no deviation from that here. The four angels, four winds, four corners of the earth. The earth doesn't have little corners to it, right? Unless you're a flat earth person, which if you are, okay, you need to check out some photographs. But you know, there is the idea though that there's just this four aspects. We do have, you know, like if you think about it, we have four directions, right? North, south, east, west. Those are four directions. And I saw another angel, he says in verse 2, ascending from the rising of the sun. What is that? Ascending from the rising of the sun. Where does the sun rise? In the east. The temple faced the east. A lot of temples faced the east because that was the rising of the sun, indicating a rising of power and strength and the new day, the newness of day. Having the seal of the living God, and he cried out with a loud voice to the four angels, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads." This is not a new thing. If you go into the Old Testament and you look at, say, Ezekiel chapter 9, I think I mentioned this before, in prior to the destruction of Jerusalem, Ezekiel saw this prophecy, or saw this vision, rather, of a prophecy. And the angel, in this case, is told, go through the midst of the city, even Jerusalem, put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations. So this is very similar here. What? No? Nothing up there yet? Okay, thank you. All right, so now you can see, right? Or you will. Look at that. That is good, huh? Yeah, that takes years of experience. Don't try that on your own. You'll just get hurt. Okay, so you see there in verse 4 of Ezekiel 9, you know, this same idea. There's this marking or distinguishing or sealing, as we see back in Revelation chapter 7, the sealing of the people of God, okay? The bondservants of our God, and they're sealed on their foreheads. So all the people in the church on the earth literally got some mark emblazoned on their forehead, right? No. Why am I saying no? Because some people, some religions do teach this, literally happens. And so this is a vision, and this is a visionary aspect of the vision. This is not real, this is not literal, but it is true nonetheless, okay? When I say it's not real, I mean it's not really happening as a seal putting on your forehead, but it is real in the sense of God knows who are his, right? 2 Timothy 2:19 says that. The Lord knows who are his, and let everyone who belongs to God abstain from every form of wickedness. So we're told elsewhere that God does know who belongs to him. Here we're seeing it graphically illustrated in this portrayal of sealing those who belong to God. And then we have the number of those who were sealed, 144,000. Okay, if the seal itself is in a visionary context and is not literal, then is the 144,000 literal or figurative? Because it's still in the vision. Remember what I told you at the beginning of the study? You can't bounce back and forth between between literal and figurative, or literal and symbolic, without the context telling you to do so. And there's been no change in the context here. John is seeing, and in this case, hearing certain things in this visionary context. And so the things remain visionary or symbolic or figurative until John tells us differently. There are some asides where it's kind of like he steps aside and says, now, this is what this really is, okay? And he does do that. We'll get to those in due time. But here he has not done that. So we're keeping this as we did with the seal itself. We're keeping this figurative. And so, from the tribe of Judah, Reuben, Gad, and so on, 12,000 from each tribe. Well, if the 144,000 as a complete number is symbolic, then what about the tribes and the 12,000 from each tribe? Is that literal or is that symbolic? That too is symbolic. How do I know that? Because the context has not changed. Nothing's changed. We're still in the visionary context, right? Imagine if I were telling you a dream I had, and I'm telling you all these bizarre things that are going on in that dream, because dreams are bizarre. If you have them, they can get really weird. So suppose I was telling you stuff like, well, and I was in this car, and the next thing I know, I'm in a bus, and the next thing I know, I'm driving downtown, and then I'm jumping on top of a skyscraper, and then I'm leaping off, and then there was this big ocean. Okay, in the midst of all that, okay, which one of those things is real or literal, and which one of those is visionary? It's all visionary. Why? Because I'm telling you about the dream. The context is my dream. You can't pull one of those out and say, oh, that was real. You really did jump off a skyscraper into an ocean, right? No, it's all part of the dream. This is all part of the vision. And the reason I'm saying that so emphatically here is because there are so many, especially in the realm or the world of premillennialism, which is extremely popular today in its so-called interpretation of Revelation, who take this very literally and say that this is about Jews, actual Jews, 144,000 Jews. And this is where a lot of the sympathy for the Jewish nation comes in, is because a lot of people in America and abroad believe that God still has some lingering, unfinished business with the Jews. And this is proof of that, that God in the end times is going to bring in 144,000 Jews into the Messianic kingdom, and that those people will have special privilege, and they will be specially held, and they will be exalted above all the rest of the earth, and so on and so on. There's all these things that are said about them. That is not at all what this is talking about. If this is symbolic, as the context says that it is, then this whole picture of the sealing of these alleged Jews, and how many there are, and how many total there are, is all symbolic as well. Does that make sense? And if that's true, then this isn't talking about Jews at all. And it's not talking about a literal 144,000 at all. And it's not talking about literal seals in the forehead at all. But it is talking about God identifying and thus protecting, by his power and authority, those who belong to him, who are symbolized as Jews. Why would God symbolize his people, Christians, as Jews? Why do you suppose he would do that in this vision? What's that? They're the chosen people. They had a covenant with God. They are protected by God. They were exalted above the rest of the world by God. And they were also given great responsibility because of that by God. All of that is true about Christians. And so they provide an ideal word picture or symbol of who we are without actually identifying us. Okay? So, for what it's worth, here's my take on this, and I do explain this to the best of my ability in the worksheet on page 8 down near the bottom, that the 12,000 is a composite number, 12 times 10 times 10 times 10, and then that 12 times 12,000 is 144. These 12s have to do with or correspond to the 12 tribes of Israel as well as the 12 apostles that were to preach to the Jewish nation. In other words, it's talking about a people. The number 12 in this context always refers to a people of God. Whether it's the Israelites or the church, it's talking about a people of God. And so, with that in mind, the 144,000 isn't talking about any particular people of God in any one place, but rather all the people of God on the face of the planet. Now, are there literally 144,000 Christians in the world when John wrote this? Honestly, I believe there are probably a lot more, but that's not the point. It's a number that represents something. It's not the number itself. In other words, it's not a numerical value. It's a symbol. It's something that stands for something else. Does that make sense? Now, our premillennialistic friends do not see that way. They go into all kinds of bizarre, sometimes, theories about how God is going to, you know, again, usher in all these great favors to the Jewish nation. The same Jewish nation that, by the way, rejected Jesus as their Messiah, even to this day. The same Jewish nation that was condemned by God and Christ for doing so, was leveled to the ground in Jerusalem because of all that, and was left behind as far as the continuing on in fellowship with God, because the covenant that God had with them was completely fulfilled in Christ. It was all done. God is done with Israel. And a lot of people are shocked to hear that, because they think, and I believe even some of our government officials think, because we kind of have this big tie with Israel, right? And there's a reason for that, because a lot of people think that Israel is going to play into the end time somehow, and it would be good then to be partners with them. Not only that, but they have a very strategic place over there in the where all the oil is, okay? So there's other factors as well. Any comments on this? Roy, did you have something?
I was just going to say, the number 12 was also a complete, it covered everyone, like you said, it's the whole earth. Mm-hmm. And that number is just...
Well, it's a multiple. Number 12 is 4 times 3. So you got 4, which is what?
The earth.
And then you've got 3, which is the Godhead, times each other, which is a people of God on the earth. This is how you read numerology. I mean, this is how you come to those conclusions. The number 12 isn't just a random number that God picked out, 12's my favorite number. Let's use, it's not like that. It has to reference other numbers, other factors, other things that it symbolizes there. 12 times 12, of course, 144,000, would mean a complete people. Times 1,000 would mean, 144,000 would mean all the people who are the people of God. In other words, the absolute complete number of that. I can't prove this absolutely, because Scripture is obviously portraying all this in the midst of a vision. But if you look at all the other scriptures that have to do with 12 and Israel, the tribes of Israel, and the 12 apostles and all of that, then you can see how this all fits together very nicely. Jim. It doesn't seem big.
It doesn't seem like a big.
Right. Doesn't have to.
In relation to the human population.
Right.
So does it have anything to do with a percentage? Like God's people is a small percentage.
Well, okay. Proportional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is proportional. A small number compared to the whole number. Well, if you think about it, I mean, you got 12 apostles for all the millions of Jews that were in the world at the time. It's a small number in comparison to the whole. But it's not important that it's a small number. What's important is that what it represents. I do think you're right on that, Lori. Yeah. Yeah, using the Jews to, as really the, what should have been the epitome of God's people, at least from the Old Testament. Yes. Okay. Did you have more? Okay. So this is what's happening here. You'll notice, too, that there's some odd things about the listing of the tribes. Does anyone know that there's a tribe missing? Now you're all going to be looking. Well, we're waiting on that. Ivan, go ahead.
Can we touch on that? Most people still in the Old Testament, anyone in terms of their back.
Okay, anyone who turns his back, what? Well, God did say to Abraham, and by extension to anyone who belongs to God, whoever blesses you, I will bless. Whoever curses you, I will curse. That's in Genesis 12, 1 through 3. So that is a consistent principle that we do see throughout all of the Old Testament. Israel is the Jews. The Jews is a later name for Israel as a whole. Technically speaking, the Jews are people from Judah. That's where the Jew name comes from. Okay, generally speaking, the Jews by the New Testament time came to represent all of Israel, or all Israelites. Because remember the kingdom split? You remember all that? 1 Kings 12, the kingdom split. You had the 10 tribes going to the north, and then the other two to the south. Judah being the really absorbing everything to the south and becoming a nation unto itself. So the Israelites, technically, in the Old Testament were of the northern tribes, and then the other Israelites, and came to be known as the Jews, were into the south. But that name didn't become commonly used until after the exile, the post-Babylonian exile, and well into the New Testament times. Okay? Anyone else? Which tribe is missing? Dan. Okay. You'll notice also that Manasseh and Manasseh and Ephraim. That's what I'm going to get at. Manasseh is here, but Ephraim is not. But it says the tribe of Joseph. But Joseph was Ephraim and Manasseh. So in other words, what I'm saying is that there's some inconsistencies. Which, this is Chad's opinion, you don't have to agree with this. That is a clue to anyone reading this that this is not meant to be taken literally. That is a clue that God snuck in there to show that these are figurative, these are symbolic, don't take it literally because it can't be substantiated literally. It's very similar to, if you look at Ezekiel, chapter 40 through 48, the whole latter part of Ezekiel, he spends a lot of time measuring this temple, this future temple that physically can't be built. It's just physically impossible to build this temple, but he's out there measuring this temple. And that's kind of God's way of saying, I'm not talking about a literal temple. I'm not talking about a physical building to be built. I'm talking about a people. And people can be measured. So to speak, right? And people can be known and people can be identified differently than buildings. So there's these kind of latent clues, these little gems, I think, as I call them, that God slips in there to let you know that this is not to be taken the way that you would upon first reading. Now imagine a Roman, say even a Roman official, reading Revelation. And he's coming across all this stuff about Jews and everything. What do you think he's going to be thinking about? He's going to be taking it literal, right? Because that's what it looks like at first reading. It looks like he's talking about Jews. What does this have to do with us? Well, nothing. But really, it is all about them. But it's not meant to be known by just anyone reading this. Revelation, the reason why people struggle with Revelation is because you really have to become a student of the entire Bible to understand this book. And until you do go into, like what we have done in our own studies here, go into books like Zechariah and Daniel and Ezekiel and other places and understand those prophets and what they dealt with and the visions and the dreams they had and how they were explained, until you see all that and get that, you're really not prepared to read Revelation, because you're going to read things that you don't know what's being talked about. And yet, if you do know those things, and then you read this, you're going to be like, oh, well, I know what that means. I see what that's talking about. I remember that from the Old Testament. I remember that from Ezekiel. I remember that from Daniel. I remember that from, you know, all these other places. And so it's not so mysterious and cryptic as it appears to be at first. But then there's the curiosity side of things, where everyone wants Revelation to be this big mystery to solve. You know, not something to understand, but rather a big mystery to crack. And that's not how it's supposed to be there. All right. So the four winds are held back, which means that there is activity that's going to come upon the world, but God is going to hold things back until he makes sure that his people are identified and thus protected. That's the message right here so far in this chapter. And after these things, in other words, after seeing and hearing those things, seeing the angels and hearing the angel talk and hearing about the 12,000 from each tribe and so on, after these things, behold, a great multitude which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. What is this telling you? All nations, every tribe, tongue. Are these Jews now? Can't possibly be Jews. So what is he telling you here? This great multitude, these are all standing before the throne and before the Lamb. Where are these people? They're not here. Okay? Yes, Ivan, you're correct. Ivan's back there going like this. He's correct. They're in the attic. They're in heaven with God. So he's seeing what's happening on the earth. There's 144,000 people being sealed of God on earth, but then in heaven there's this great multitude in which there are no ethnic or national distinctions at all. So these people are standing before the throne. Now, are they literally standing before the throne? Again, we're symbolic here, right? Are they literally clothed in white robes and are there literal palm branches in their hands? No, this is all symbolic. We know what white means. White means purity, okay? We know what the palm branches refer to, right? Right? From, you could say, the entrance of a king. Remember when Jesus came into Jerusalem? What did they put on the ground? Had palm branches and robes, right, that they threw on the ground for him. In other words, the idea of celebration. Remember the Feast of the Tabernacles? What are they supposed to live in? Booths, right? And those booths were made of branches, palm branches and otherwise. So we see there's a celebration here. And they cry out with a loud voice, salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. In other words, salvation to both. Not that they need saved, but that salvation comes from them. And then we see this other celebration erupting in heaven like we saw back in chapter 5. The angels, the elders, the four living creatures. Remember, we've seen all these beings here, these personages before. And they all worship God, in, as you see there in verse 12. Blessing, glory, wisdom, thanksgiving, honor, power, and might. There's a sevenfold blessing to our God forever and ever. Amen. And then here's a kind of an aside here, almost like we're stepping out of the vision for a minute. The elders says, do you know who these people are? And John wisely says, you know, right? He doesn't say, well, I have a good guess, or let me pose an idea. He just simply says, my Lord, you know. And he says, these are the ones who come out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And for this reason, they are before the throne of God. So it's kind of a stepping out of the vision, and here's this angel stepping out with John and says, you don't understand what's going on. Do you see what's happening here? Do you understand what you're seeing? And John basically says, no, I don't, but you do. And so he explains it. This is the people who have gone through the trials, the tribulation. Now the question is, has the tribulation already happened, or is the tribulation about to happen? And he's seeing this in a future tense. And I don't know that for sure. My theory, Chad's theory, if you want to accept it, is both. That this represents those who already have been martyred for the sake of Christ and those who will be martyred for the sake of Christ. John is seeing this as a victory celebration for both groups, for what it's worth. You can disagree with me if you want to, but what good would that do you, right? I mean, it really doesn't matter in the end who's right or wrong on that. We do know that this is souls in heaven being portrayed, and you know, that at least for the purpose of John's vision. And so for this reason, he says there before the throne of God, they worship him day and night. He who sits on the throne will spread his tabernacle over them. In other words, another way of saying God's going to take care of them. This is one of the great things about Scripture here, is what it presents heaven to be. Is a hunger no longer, thirst no longer, the sun will not beat down on them. Think about a worker who is out in the hot sun all day, slaving under the hot sun. That will no longer be necessary, nor any heat, no excessive heat, that is. For the Lamb in the center of the throne will be their shepherd. Notice that. The Lamb will be their shepherd. What do shepherds do? They shepherd lambs. Here we have the Lamb who is also a shepherd. Dual role, right? Doing both things. Being a lamb as far as atonement is concerned, the lamb that takes away the sin of the world, and also the shepherd who guides, leads, feeds, nurtures, protects his people. And he will guide them to springs of water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. I'm sure there was a great deal of sorrow, not only being killed, but also watching others being killed. I can just only imagine how horrible that would be to watch people killed. I mean, just imagine for a moment, if you would, just, you know, a whole bunch of Christians from the Puget Sound area, not just us, but people that we know, and the government taking them and slaughtering them before our eyes, maybe gunning them down or just killing them in some other form of execution. And we're watching that, knowing that that's going to happen to us pretty soon too. There'd be a lot of tears for that. But God is going to wipe all that away, because all that will be in the past. That will be behind us by this point if we are part of this group, and we will not have to worry about having to go through that ever again. So there's great hope, great consolation for God's people there because of this. Any comments, questions? Ivan? Remember, this is a vision, okay? So it's not talking about literal food or water, but it is talking about we're not going to need any more the earthly provisions anymore, because we're not in an earthly place. Right now, your body needs food and water and air to survive, but in heaven, you're going to have a spiritual body, a heavenly body. You will have a body, we're told that, but it will not need what it does here on earth. So there's that to consider in that, but also the idea of you're not going to have to be dependent upon earthly supplies, earthly sustenance any longer, because God, that's what he's saying when God's spreading his tabernacle. You're going to be in the midst of God. God will take care of you. God will take care of all your needs, whatever they are. And I don't know what our needs would be in heaven, but whatever they are, he'll take care of them, which is a great thing to think about. It's a good thing to think about as you're drifting off to sleep tonight. Put that in your head. God's going to take care of me. If I'm faithful to him, he's going to take care of me just like he took care of these people. Chances are you probably won't have to die a martyr's death. So you'll be spared what these people went through. But at the same time, you are expected to be faithful like these people were faithful. So faithfulness is not an option. How you die, whether as a martyr or natural death or otherwise, that remains to be seen. But faithfulness is a constant in all cases. Comments? Questions? Jim? My opinion is all I can give you, but I believe these questions are not posed so much for John, but they're posed for all those who read this. They're explanatory. It's an opportunity. It's a teaching tool. Do you know what this means? Right? It's kind of like when Jesus was asked questions, or Jesus asked questions, I should say. He was asked one time, who is my neighbor? It was an opportunity for him to explain, but then he would pose questions sometimes. I'm thinking to Peter there in Matthew 17, where he says, what do you think? Should the sons of the king have to pay taxes or not? Right? I mean, that's a question he's posing. But he wasn't posing it just for Peter. He's really posing it for us. So these are explanatory opportunities, or teaching moments, we might say. Not meant for John to have, put him on the spot. I don't think he would have known, or could have known, or should have known. But it just gives opportunity for the elder to explain these things. Good question. Yeah.
I always, when you get through looking at this, I always take it back and go, okay, what would the seven churches be getting out of this? Because that's where we technically would be too.
Right. Right.
And so anytime you get confused with it, it's like, well, what would this mean to the churches if this is being read to them like this?
Right.
What would they get out of that?
Right. It's a good point. So if you're on the earth, then are you protected by God, preserved by God? Absolutely are. That's what the sealing on the forehead represents. But if you do have to die a martyr's death, are you going to be with God and protected forever?
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's a no-lose situation, in a sense. I mean, whether I'm on the earth or whether I'm in heaven, I'm with the Lord. He's taking care of me. And so I need to be faithful to him. Now, granted, those still on earth may have to undergo a fiery ordeal, as Peter put it, in order to overcome. But if we take God at his word, 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation shall overtake you such as is common to man. God is faithful not to let you, if I could paraphrase, to be tempted beyond your means. So they're not going to be given more than they can handle. It might be severe, it might be intense, but it won't be more than they can handle. Which is a good thing for us to think about, because we think we have been conditioned, and when I say we, Americans, have been conditioned that we need everything thus and so. We need all our amenities, creature comforts, conveniences, and a soft padded environment, and so on. And that if we have less than that, then we're uncomfortable, and our world's falling apart, and we just can't go on anymore, right? I mean, that's how we're conditioned. But the fact of the matter is, you could probably put up with an awful lot if you had to. An awful lot of trial, awful lot of deprivation, an awful lot of, going without or having to do some hard work. And even with regard to persecution, you could probably endure more than you think you could if it meant being faithful to God. I don't believe God is going to push any of us past the point where we can hang on to our faith. He's going to allow us to hang on to our faith. You have to trust God in that. That he won't give you more than you can endure, right? For example, I've thought about this many times. If I were back in this day, and I was one of those that was, put in the arena with the wild animals, or if I was one of those like what Nero did with them, he dipped them in hot oil and put them on pikes and burned them in the city of Rome, or he dipped them in hot oil slowly so that they just kind of, boiled incrementally. I don't know if I could handle that. I don't know that I would be able to handle that. I would probably go insane if that happened to me, I think. But if God is going to protect me in the way that I believe he will, and that was truly too much for me, then he would not have me go through that. That doesn't mean I wouldn't die some other, you know, awful way, but I wouldn't be given a kind of death that would force me to recant my faith because I was trying to avoid it. You see what I'm saying? You say, you think about stuff like this? I know, it sounds awful. But, I mean, you do have to think about what these people were going through and would have to go through. We know this historically. These people, some of them, went through some pretty grisly scenarios. And I don't want any of us to have to go through any of that. However, if we did have to go through something, would it be something that we could endure? And the answer is yes, it would. Okay? So I don't know what the future holds for Christians. There might be a time in our future. I hope it's in the distant future, but in our future where, you know, the government comes along at gunpoint, takes you from your house, you lose your house, you lose your car, you lose your job, you lose everything, and you're thrown in prison, and that's where you're going to be for the rest of your life. That sounds like an awful thing to me. Could we endure that? I don't want to. I'm not asking for that, but could we endure that? I mean, that's a question that we would have to come to terms with, you see. Now, if you couldn't endure it, then God wouldn't have that happen to you, is what I'm saying. And I'm not here to tell you who's going to be given what. I don't know your limitations any more than I even know mine, but God knows them all. I hope that makes sense, what I'm saying, and didn't just scare you all half to death, right? I'm just being realistic. I'm trying to see ourselves, you know, in parallel to what we're reading about right here. Okay? Yeah, Paula.
Sometimes we don't know our potential until it's tested.
We don't know what? Our potential? Right.
And that's, I think sometimes he puts us through things to help us to grow in that way.
Right. Well, there's room for growth. There's, you know, as we said many times, what's our faith if it's never tested? You know, it has to be tested. Now, how far does it have to be tested? That's a question that God alone can answer. But it does need to be tested. So, Nita?
We just endured COVID.
We did. Right. It's true. Right.
And strained relationships within congregations.
Right. Yeah, if you didn't hear, Anita said, we just went through COVID, meaning the shutdown and all the government intrusion and everything that went with it, all that package there. And you know, there might be other generations that just couldn't have coped with that in the way that we did. Maybe they would have done better, I don't know. But the thing is, we have been through the fire on some level here, I think is what you're getting at, right? Right. What is waiting for those who overcome is really the question, the rhetorical question that needs to be asked here. Lori.
We kind of have to have a certain attitude and mindset that failure is not going to be an option.
Right. Failure in the sense of recanting our faith and just giving up and, you know, going back on our promise to God. And we just that's not acceptable. That's not even on the table. Mike?
You know, one thing, man can destroy the body, but he cannot destroy the soul.
Right.
I mean, God can do that. That's kind of the way I look at it.
Sure.
Understanding people's power.
And that does sound good in theory, but man can destroy the body pretty painfully, right?
Very much so. I agree with that. And I don't know how I would react either.
Yeah. Still doing it, in my understanding.
It's just
that nobody's covering it.
I know one in Pakistan, a young boy, is getting executed.
Yep. There's so much going on in the world that you don't hear about against Christians. And the reason you don't hear about it is because nobody cares. If they were doing these things to Muslims or Jews, you would hear about it. But they're doing it to Christians, and nobody cares. And so the news doesn't cover it. You know that there's reasons for that. I don't want to get into. But there's no one covering all these stories. But those who are investigating it, and you can go and find this out on the internet, there's organizations who are looking at who the most persecuted groups in the world are. Christians are at the top. Christians are number one. And they go through and list all the atrocities that you're talking about. And so we think, you know, well, we don't hear about Christians being persecuted today, but maybe someday it'll happen. It's happening every day all over the world. And we're just not hearing about it because we're getting very selective news from our news sources. So, you know, it is happening. It may happen here in due time. I don't know. I don't want it to. But on the other hand, maybe that's what we need. Certainly what we deserve as a nation is some trouble. But I just don't want that trouble to come upon the faithful people of God. For what it's worth. All right, let's go into chapter 8. The Lamb broke the seventh seal. So remember, that was an interlude. We had the six seals, all kinds of trouble against the natural world itself there, in essence. And now we have the seventh seal broke, and there was silence in heaven for about half an hour. And I saw the seven angels who stand before God, and seven trumpets were given them. It's kind of an overlapping. As you see, the seventh seal overlaps with basically now the seven trumpets. And then when the seventh trumpet is sounded, it overlaps with the bowls of wrath. And you see an intensity, the seals, the trumpets, the bowls. The seals are information. The trumpets are what? What do we sound a trumpet for? Warning. The bowls are punishment, right? Message, warning, punishment is really what you're seeing. In that order. So, and we see another angel. Now, there's all these angels with different roles. That's one thing that I think is fascinating in Revelation. Now, I don't believe these, again, are always literal events here. That's not what it's supposed to be. But we do see God using angels. A lot of people say, what do angels do today? I don't know, but I know they're really busy in heaven. And they're doing a lot of things in heaven, if this is to be taken at any semblance of the truth. And so another angel came, stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and incense was given to him so that he might add to it the prayers of all the saints. Golden altar, golden censer, incense, where have we heard this before? The temple. Remember, right before the Holy of Holies, there was the golden altar. It's what it was called. And that golden altar, its sole purpose was on the top of it. It had a golden censer. And incense was placed in that censer and lit and created smoke so as to obscure the opening of the veil of the Holy of Holies when the priest went in there. So that the priest and anyone else could not see into the Holy of Holies very well. To obscure it, meaning because this is such a sacred place and a sacred experience here that it was not meant for human eyes. It was not meant to be a casual or common thing. Now what are we seeing? Well, that same idea here, that same idea of this incense going up, now not as obscurity, but rather as the prayers of the saints. And so we see that smoke of the incense going up, and God you know, as it says here in verse 4, went up before God out of the angel's hand. And so God is hearing or recognizing, acknowledging the prayers of the saints. You think the saints on earth are praying to God at all at this point? Probably profusely, right? And partly because, well, they're faithful people. They're going to pray anyway, but they're also praying more than usual, if perhaps, because of the great turmoil that they're going through. And so what's the message? Like Roy said earlier, what's the message to the seven churches? God is hearing your prayers. God is listening to you. Don't stop praying, because God is listening to your prayers, and this is indicative of that here. Did you have a comment too? Okay. Does anyone else have a comment? All right, and verse 5, the angel took the censer and filled it with the fire of the altar and threw it on the earth, and there followed peals of thunder and sounds and flashes of lightning and an earthquake. So this is because of the prayer, as I understand this, what this is really saying is because of the prayers that are offered, God is going to act, and that act is going to be a form of judgment against the people causing the saints their problems. There's the Roman Empire is causing the saints, the churches, all these problems here. As I say here, the casting of fire upon the earth from the holy altar indicates the answer to those prayers being given. So God is responding now. He's saying, you're praying to me. And that comes up as incense, something very soothing, that is very pleasing. But the response then is going to take the fire of those coals and throw it down upon the earth, which brings its own kinds of problems. So now we have the seven trumpets here, the seven angels to sound the seven trumpets. And the first trumpet sounds, and there comes hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth. And a third of the earth was burned up. A third of the trees were burned up. And a third of, and all the green grass, rather, was burned up. And then something like a great mountain burning with fire thrown into the sea upon the second blowing of the trumpet, or second trumpet being blown, I should say. And the third of the sea became blood. A third of the creatures in the sea that had life died. A third of the ships were destroyed. A third angel sounded, a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. It fell on the rivers and the springs of water. The star had a name, and a third of the waters became that name, wormwood. And many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. And then the fourth angel sounded, and then the third of the sun, a third of the moon, a third of the stars were struck so that the light was obscured. Do you notice anything in common between these first four trumpets and what they're the actions of these trumpets? Do you notice anything? Well, what's that? The elements are all being affected, okay? Which is good. Sarah? Correct. There's a limitation on the affectation or on the devastation. It's a third, so not totally, right? And what else? This is the harder one. Right. So God is making this known. Remember, he threw down the fire of the censer from heaven. Where are all these troubles coming from upon the earth? From above. Have you noticed that? Every one of these are coming from above here. All right. So if we go back here, we see the first, and there's hail and fire thrown to the earth, right? Second angel, a great mountain burning with fire, was thrown into the sea, obviously from the sky. Third angel, a great star falls from heaven. The fourth angel, third of the sun, third of the moon. These are all heavenly, what we consider heavenly sources or heavenly objects here. Things that are coming from heaven. Now, when we looked at the seals, remember when the seals were being broken, we saw devastation on the earth coming from the earth. Now we're seeing devastation coming from God. So the first time is kind of a preemptive strike, if you will. And now God is showing those being afflicted, which in the course of this class is the Roman Empire, that he himself is involved in this judgment. In other words, this is not a coincidence. This is not an accident. This cannot be blamed on, happenstance or anything else. This is a divine judgment against the empire. Now, these things aren't literally all happening, of course, but the judgment is real. Remember, these point to actual truths. They're not true as far as being literally done, but they are true as far as what they convey, a judgment against the empire. Make sense? Okay, let's close with that because we're out of time. And so we will go ahead and stop here and transition to the next part of our assembly here.